Last time, we looked at a bunch of different passages related to this business of, we'd start out looking at imminence, this idea of when this transformation that's in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 51 and 53, we were looking at the timing of it. We looked at imminence, and then we looked at other reasons that contribute to the idea that it would occur before the tribulation. And in particular, we were trying to make the point, or I was trying to make the point, that when you look at the various coming passages in the New Testament that talk about future times of Christ's coming that are still future from our time, that there's really three possible situations that any of those verses could be talking about. One is the second coming, which, you know, when he physically comes a second time to take up his rule. The other one is the rapture, where he comes to take the church. And then the third one, which I think a lot of times doesn't get enough attention, is when he comes as a thief on an unsuspecting world and ushers in the tribulation, basically the day of the Lord. So
now that, how do we recognize that one?
How do we recognize that one? Yeah. The way we recognize that one, there's several ways, I think. One is when it emphasizes peace and safety or suddenness, unexpectedness, and it's a judgment-related coming. So the rapture, he doesn't come in judgment at the rapture.
No, what I mean is, I'm sorry.
Okay.
At the rapture, we actually see it.
Right.
The believers see it.
Right.
At the second coming, everybody sees him.
Right.
Who sees him at that other?
Right. So it would be more akin to Pentecost, which is a non-physical coming,
okay.
Right? We haven't bothered to go back and look at John 17, but if we did, there where he's promising the Comforter, right? And he says, I won't leave you orphans, I'll come to you. And so, prior to his ascension, he tells them, go and wait in Jerusalem for the promise of the Father. And of course, they don't necessarily know what the promise of the Father is. I mean, there's things in the Old Testament you can read about that give you a clue that it has to do with God putting his Spirit on people or in people, filling them with his Spirit. But when they go to Jerusalem, they don't have a specific thing that Jesus has told them will happen, but they go there with the understanding that he's told them there to wait there, and something's going to happen that they can tell. And then we look in the book of Pentecost, we see that there's those tongues as of fire, the mighty rushing wind, and speaking in tongues. So all those things make it clear to them that, okay, this must be it. Now in the case of the day of the Lord, we have to look at various things. The main thing we'd look at there is the idea that God is going to intervene in the world in a way where there's dramatic judgments that are not like what history has seen in the past. So like as in the days of Noah, right? The same sort of scope. So the tricky part comes from, you know, at the worst part of World War I or the worst part of World War II, right at that point, how can you differentiate that from maybe the beginning of the day of the Lord, right? I mean, because things are just really out of whack on the global scale in a large way. But I think the biblical student would have to look at aspects of the Bible, such as, for instance, for the church, if you believe that the rapture is imminent, then, or, you know, there's no precondition for it, one of the things we believe is that the rapture will occur either before or simultaneously with the beginning of the day of the Lord. So if the rapture hasn't happened, the day of the Lord won't be something you would be looking for yet. And then there's specific events that are tied to the beginning of, or the early part of the day of the Lord. Those are a little bit harder to know for sure whether everybody will be able to detect those. like when the Lamb takes the first seal off the scroll in Revelation 6, that horse, the white horseman, comes forth. How easily the world will be able to tell who that white horseman is, or even Christians at the time, isn't real clear. At some point he gains prominence, and then he signs that, you know, he signs his covenant, or makes a covenant with Israel in Daniel 9 that you're aware of, and that those are the events that would be up at the very head of the day of the Lord, where God is loosing things that are going to lead to obvious wrath and tribulation, but you don't see the physical events of it yet. So I think knowing for sure exactly when it starts might be difficult. Yeah.
I've heard that the signal for the beginning of the tribulation is the Antichrist making the confirming the covenant.
Right.
And that brings in a period of peace that might point to the peace and safety that they're talking about.
Right. If you take the peace and safety to be either just in the land of Israel, or the fact that there isn't peace and safety worldwide because of problems with Israel, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible.
Another thought is that the book of Revelation is directed at the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And when it talks about the covenant and the land and all of those things, that these are Jewish.
In Daniel, for sure.
Well, yeah, but also since we're not there during the tribulation, it would be that would indicate that they're not, it's not talking to believers. I mean, there will be tribulation saints and all that stuff, but the 70th week is a Jewish thing. It's not it's not a worldwide thing. I mean, it's worldwide happening,
right?
But it's not the whole purpose of it is to bring.
Well, that
Jews
part of it, yeah.
Yeah,
but you know, if you look in Revelation 7 and you look at the 144,000 witnesses, from the 12 tribes, right after that it mentions an innumerable, a huge number of people from every tribe, family,
right,
and nation that come to faith.
Right.
So even though there is a focus where God's focusing back on the Jewish nation and getting it to where it's supposed to be. I don't think it's exclusive, though, see, because there's just lots of indications in the book of Revelation that, like, the mark of the beast is going to affect everyone in the whole world.
Yeah.
And that there will be a large number of people who come to faith who aren't Jewish as well. So that's where I think it gets a little trickier. So when you get, you know, when you get far enough into the events in the book of Revelation, some of them are very clearly of a certain significance that anyone who knows anything about the Bible will know. But the very beginning part, like when he signs this covenant, you know, what if someone today signs a covenant with Israel, like people talked about Arafat or whatever, you know, is it such that every person that comes along that might sign a covenant with Israel could be the Antichrist, or are there other factors as well that would indicate we're not that far along? And I'm one that would say that there's other factors that indicate we're not that far along. But it's hard to know how visible all that's going to be. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it says he signs a covenant, but is everyone who's up to speed on the Bible going to know that's the covenant, that one, and that's the guy, even though he hasn't really revealed his other characteristics yet? You know, maybe, maybe not. I think it's hard to say for sure. But when you get to the place where there's fairly large events going on, or especially when you get to the point where the two witnesses are prophesying, right? And they're supposed to prophesy for the first half of that week. So they're going to be starting to do that pretty soon after that covenant signer, maybe right at the same time. you know, that's probably going to be more visible than the signing of the covenant, maybe, necessarily. Because, I mean, the whole world celebrates when they get rid of them.
You don't have a, you don't have anything in mind that may trigger the peace and safety thing?
Well, I see the peace and safety statement in Matthew 24 and also in Thessalonians where Paul talks about it. I see it as just more or less saying that the world's going along in its normal pattern. In other words, they don't expect the judgment of God. I don't see it as saying that the world has this unusual time of peace that hasn't been seen before. I mean, that's possible, but that's not really how
because,
I've seen it.
Well, you know, in Ezekiel where it talks about God coming down
right.
and to a land of unwalled cities
right.
And safety or peace or
mm-hmm.
is mentioned then.
Right. But I take that to be specific to Israel there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the land of Israel.
So that was my thought, that this whole thing basically is specific to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's going to be, the whole world's going to be affected by it,
mm-hmm.
by the wrath of God, and it's going to,
mm-hmm.
the purpose is to bring people to believe, not
mm-hmm.
just Israel, but... I don't know. I guess I just didn't, the concept of the what you're talking about there is I've never heard before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm getting off into the weeds.
No, that's all right.
Into the weeds.
Well, the comparison to the days of Noah,
right,
kind of for me pictures just business as usual. You know, it doesn't really point to all of a sudden this, you know, a dramatic
peace, yeah.
change to peace and safety. It's just they're going along,
married,
minding their own
yeah.
whatever, and
right.
boom, you know.
Right.
That's kind of how I get
they're,
that.
They're oblivious, and then all of a sudden
yeah.
it's there.
Right. And I also, the other reasons I see it as a global thing, I mean, it could, I mean, obviously a lot of the tension in the world comes about because of what's going on in Israel,
mm-hmm.
right, in the Middle East. But when he makes an analogy of the days of Noah, that again is more of a global sort of thing. When they say peace and safety, the idea of the world is saying peace and safety. And then also the issue where when it talks about people taken in judgment, you know, I don't think it's just a Jewish context there. You know, I think it's talking about the fact that once the day of the Lord starts, a lot of people will die. You know, not just in the Jewish context. So it's a little tricky because in Matthew 24 and in the book of Revelation, there are definitely Jewish elements that a lot of people totally ignore. But I think there's other aspects to them, though, that make it clear that they have a global scope as well. And that's why I've always seen the peace and safety there as basically indicating that, at least in the passage in not in the passage in Daniel, but the passage in Thessalonians and the one in Matthew 24, I see that as just him saying, you know, the world's going to be going along and it's normal thing, not thinking anything unusual is
yeah,
coming.
Yeah, I believe that too.
Yeah.
But the conflict, don't want to belabor, but the conflict always centers around Israel. Jerusalem is
mm-hmm.
is the cup of trembling, and the conflict is always there. So if that conflict in the Middle East between the Israelis and the
mm-hmm.
and the Arabs or the surrounding
right.
Muslim populace, if that is brought to an end
right.
Through this covenant,
mm-hmm.
then that would basically signal peace for the whole world, because
mm-hmm.
this whole world is,
uh-huh.
is what's and it talks about, well, I don't even know if it's related, but it does talk about the whole world coming against Jerusalem,
right?
Which would mean us and everybody else,
right.
But all nations, I can't remember how it says it, but,
mm-hmm.
but the fact that is the boiling point right,
right.
there in the Middle East. That's where probably the next big war is going to end up in there, and maybe it's Ezekiel 38, or mm-hmm. maybe it's not. I don't really know. But
uh-huh.
So that's why I and the teaching I've heard as it seems to be a Calvary Chapel thing anyway is the signing of the covenant
mm-hmm.
is confirming the covenant,
mm-hmm.
which it could even mean confirming Israel's right to exist as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
That could be, which was given to them by God to Abraham,
mm-hmm.
and so if that's what that means, then it would mean that may be a catalyst for peace and safety.
Right. Well, I think that's possible for sure.
Yeah.
I think that scenario is very possible. It's just when you look at, you know, even in the Old Testament, if you look at the concept of the day of the Lord, it's God comes to judge like Edom,
mm-hmm.
And the nations. Part of the reason he's judging them is they've taken away his land, right? So, I mean, it does, there's a relationship to Israel there, but the scope of the day of the Lord is a global thing. And so that's why when I'm looking at the thief business of him coming in judgment, I'm seeing that more from a global perspective, but I think the peace and safety that people think is in place could well relate to the fact that some of the conflicts that have been ongoing have been seemingly dealt with. Certainly possible. I do agree with the statement that the main thing that we know from timing that starts that 7-year period is the signing of this, the confirming of this covenant in Daniel 9:27. So, but there are other things too that I think are as visible or even more visible, because those two witnesses that they prophesy for half that period of time and then they're killed apparently in the middle, they do amazing things that the world hates. So I think that's going to be very highly visible. And then the other thing, which pretty much looks like it has to be there at that point in time, is that temple too. So if I didn't believe in a rapture and I was watching history, the next thing I would be looking for that would be highly significant, I think, is if they started building a temple or getting really serious. I mean, there's some groups planning it, but getting to the point where they actually were making progress on it.
Well, I hear they've already made all the implements.
Yeah.
They've mm-hmm. selected out through DNA or whatever the
uh-huh.
the priesthood.
Yeah.
That's all. Everything's all set and ready. They even have the red heifer,
mm-hmm.
from what I've heard. And so it's all sitting there just waiting. The temple. I forget what it's called in Israel.
Temple Faithful or Temple Institute?
Institute or something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they have everything sitting there waiting. In fact, Mike said that when he was over there,
mm-hmm.
that he's seen that. That
right.
They'll take you down and show you the implements and everything that
mm-hmm.
they made. So that's already. It's just a matter of getting... being able to put it back on the temple mount.
Well, yeah, that's the bigger
that's
issue.
The big thing.
Yeah. So you can see God moving in history in significant ways that are bringing the various chess pieces around. Like there's the nation of Israel. People are fighting over Jerusalem again, right? And there's what most people would consider some crazies out there that are getting the priesthood ready and getting these implements ready, and even a lot of Christians think that's completely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see how aspects of the scriptures point toward the reinstitution of a temple. So that's a significant thing. Just like, you know, I have a bunch of quotes from earlier Bible teachers of earlier times talking about predicting the reestablishment of the nation of Israel based on things they see, you know, when there was no Israel. Like when it says he'll sign a covenant with many in Israel, right? Or where it talks about God bringing Israel to the point of accepting Messiah, and some of the things it says about the Jews at the time of the end, they looked at those things and they decided that, you know, based on these things in the scripture, there has to be, it can't just be Jews around the world, there's got to be a nation of Israel for these things to occur. And at the time there was no nation of Israel. You know, these would have been 1700s, 1600s, some of the quotes I have maybe are even a little earlier than that. And the Zionist movement really wasn't getting underway until the 1800s, you know. But so back then, people looked at the Bible and said, you know, there's certain missing pieces, and one of the big missing pieces is that Israel needs to be back in the land, and they will be back in the land in unbelief. And here we are, in general. The nation is in the land, and it's in unbelief as a whole, not Christians. So that's a good example, I think, of a place where you can, in a valid way, look at the big stream of what the Bible teaches and look at the newspapers and say there is a correlation there. And, you know, another one would be this temple, right? So those are some things, I think, that it'll be more clear when those occur, you know. Like for me, I mean, I'm at a point where I have quite a few books on the temple, and I've read about the different movements and stuff, and I see that as significant for sure. But how long will it be before they actually can do something on the mount? That's really hard to say, because they had the mount in 1967, and then it got given back to the jurisdiction of the Muslims. And so obviously God's hand is in there, because that was completely nonsensical how that happened. And so God could move his hand where next year all of a sudden the temples, there's people are actually moving toward doing something to establish peace in the Middle East. They're going to let Israel build a temple up there or somehow or whatever, who knows. Or it could be another 200 years, or, you know, I don't know. So if they did move in that direction and things were moving on that right now, that would be hugely significant.
I just heard that it's, you know, you can throw up a temple, prefab temple or whatever, and Dubai, they just build like crazy there. I mean, you can have a temple up in no time, really.
Well, sure. Yeah, I'm not contesting how long it would take to build a temple, because I'm a person that believes that Babylon will be literal Babylon, right?
Me too, yeah.
So I'm not so concerned about how long it would take once the issues are cleared out of the way. So to me, it's just the issue of clearing those things out of the way, and that's going to be on God's timing. And I do think that the preparations that are being made and stuff like that, and the genetic stuff and all that about the priesthood, I think it's got God's hands all over it personally, you know. But again, you know, when is that going to really surge forward? It's hard to know. And, you know, I'm not trying to say either that I think that the world's at a place where it can coast along for another 1,000 years without God stepping in. Because there's a lot of really crazy things that are on the verge of happening with life and making kids out of three people and a lot of different things that are just, to me, they're like, you know, how much can you poke God's eye before he finally is going to wake up and raise himself like a mighty man, as it says in the Old Testament, you know, shake off his sleep and, you know, I mean, he has a huge amount of grace, and Peter tells us that he's not doing that because he's holding off for more people to come to salvation. But still, you got to wonder as a Christian, how far is he going to, you know, just like in the days of Noah, his spirit won't strive with man forever, right? There's a trip line where man will go to a certain point where there's a trip wire, and God says, okay, it's time to raise the curtain on the final act now.
Yeah, it would be the something of the Gentiles, the
fullness of the Gentiles.
Yeah. That's supposed to be the trip wire, I think.
Yeah. So there's all these different things that are all... It's a tapestry that God's weaving, right? And it's got Jewish purposes in it. It's got Gentile purposes in it. It's got prophecy in it. It's got just all different things. People who, in the world, I mean, like I think you mentioned on Sunday, part of what is involved there, I think, is the whole rising anti-God worldwide commitment to hate God that you see in the book of Revelation, and it's tied into heavy-duty environmentalism mm-hmm. and a belief in Mother Earth as opposed to Father God. And because when you see the whole emphasis on the earth dwellers in the book of Revelation, there's just, and the fact that God comes in and basically destroys environmental systems to say the systems aren't the God, the Creator is the God. You know, you might love those dolphins and this and that and the other, and they're cool animals, but I'm the one that made them. So, you know, when you see all these different kind of movements going along, and you see parts of Christianity getting slurped up into some of them, right? You know, those are all things that flavor your view when you look at Scripture. You can see the beginnings of these things being put in place. You can see the beginnings of people, you know, people who are just have this totally irrational, absolute hatred of God. I mean, they're just like completely flipped out about evolution or creation or whatever. I just got an email today. Amazon has this goofy policy, which I hate, where if you review a book by default, comments that people make to your review get sent to you by email. Well, first off, they never should have comments on reviews, because a review is an opinion, yeah. right? Yeah. And if someone else has another opinion, write mm-hmm. a review,
yeah.
right? But Amazon...
But that's
has,
a lot of work.
Yeah, and Amazon has figured out that people love to fight
oh, yeah.
in these forums, and it makes things popular, and they trend or whatever.
Yeah.
So if you happen to review a controversial book, you're going to get slammed, and I get slammed. So I have to go in and turn off notifications after I do a review. But what you'll find is if you review a book on evolution, say that is pointing out problems with evolution, the level of hatred and invective and non-mental thinking that's involved in the response, I mean, it's just rabid, and it's extreme, and you come away and you go, part of me goes, well, it's whatever, it's goofy, but the other part of me says, wow,
yeah,
how, you know, if I was, I mean, if it's, how can it be such a hot button, and how can they be so hating the possibility that there could be a God? I mean, they're not like, I think that's dumb and here's why. I mean, they're like rabid attack. So that, again, you look back and you go, well, how could there be this terminal generation that you see in the book of Revelation? People who, they know that it's the judgment of God, and they're still,
yeah.
I hate God.
Yeah.
Right? How could people be like that? How could you go to war against God? Right?
Blind hatred. Insanity.
Yeah, it's like Satan, essentially,
yeah.
right? It's,
yeah.
it's insanity.
Yeah.
But when you see little snippets of that, in the culture,
yeah,
and you say to yourself, wow, you know, were people that rabid about Darwin 30 years ago, 40 years ago? I don't know, but it seems like certain things have become the focal point, just like Israel is, right? Mm-hmm. Certain things have become the focal point of, this is the way we get rid of God, and we want to get rid of God in a very, very, very bad way. So anything you do that sheds trouble on our solution for getting rid of God is the hatred of God gets placed on that thing or on the people.
Yeah.
And it's pretty intense. It's pretty intense. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, how it all goes, and, you know, how long there's going to be Christians out there who continue to say that Revelation is not about literal things in the future, you know, that, you know, preterists or ones who think it's more of an allegory or whatever, you know, how long are they going to be able to hang on to that view until it becomes pretty obvious that no, it's not.
Yeah.
So any other comments or thoughts about any of the stuff that we've talked about in the last couple times? Well, maybe we should go on then, huh?
Yeah.
So, anyone want to read like verse 54 through the end of the chapter for us?
54, I'll do that.
Okay.
So when this corruptible has put on incorruption, and this mortal has put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord.
Thanks, Kevin. So he ends up quoting the Old Testament there, or at least ideas from the Old Testament, right? In verse 54, the saying that is written. And so there are these Old Testament passages that predict that death will be vanquished. And one of them is on Isaiah 25. And I think this is like so powerful how this is described in Isaiah 25 verses 7 and 8. I just love how death is described here. It seems so. It says, he will destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over all people, and the veil that spread over the nations. He will swallow up death forever. The Lord will wipe away tears from all faces. The rebuke of his people he will take away from all the earth. But notice how he talks about death. It's like this veil settled over all the nations. It's like big net. It's just smothering. So, you know, verse 8, wow, he will swallow up death forever.
So that has to be at the end of the millennium, then, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we can look at that in a minute, too. That would be helpful. Another passage I had in here was Hosea 13, verse 14. So Hosea is the first of the 12 minor prophets. Right near the, as you run up toward the end of the Bible, Old Testament.
Hosea what?
13. And in Hosea 13, verse 14, he mentions, I will ransom them from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death. O death, I will be your plague. O grave, I will be your destruction.
Is that what Jesus meant when he said the gates of hell will not prevail against the church?
I think that's part of what he meant, yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah, that it's not defensive but offensive. Yeah, he's going to storm death. But again, you see here this idea that he's going to ransom from the power of the grave. And there's some other passages as well where it talks about resurrection. But clearly the idea that God is eventually going to overcome death makes sense when you think about, you know, if you think back to the Garden of Eden, right, where Adam and Eve were without sin and they had eternal life, and then by sin God said in the day, he basically said, the day you eat of it, dying you will die. And our Bible says surely you will die, but it's kind of a Hebrew phrase, dying you will die. And essentially that's where the first mention of, you know, death comes in. And so if God is really going to fully restore, you know, if he's the God that we know him to be, he's not going to leave things undone, right? He's going to do the full job and more. And so in order to turn things back to what they originally were supposed to be, he's going to have to destroy death itself.
You know, it's so popular, the culture, in the culture, the, you know, the terms like the circle of life, you know, and things like that. I haven't seen a lot of death. I'm not a hunter or anything, but when you see something die violently, it has a profound effect. Even a chicken, you know. Mm-hmm. That's how sensitive my...
Especially the chicken.
You know. And it's just that time that I've shared that before, that we killed this chicken, and I just was thinking it's foreign. It's an enemy. Death is an enemy. It's like a foreigner that God has allowed for so many thousands of years. It's not, I don't know. That was just this kind of mushy gushy feeling about it, but it's weird.
I know, every once in a while birds come over and they get on my chimney up there and it's metal and they, you know.
Flickers, yeah.
Yeah, and so I got out there with my BB gun and the bird flew over to the tree. And usually I just scare them away, you know. Well, this time I aimed and shot and feathers flew all over the place. And I'm thinking, wow, that wasn't fun at all, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, I could shoot birds all day long and kill things, but now it's just, I don't think it's in me anymore.
Well, I know, and I eat meat and stuff, and I know that something has to die for me to do that, but I know it just seems like the ultimate plan will be no death, you know, and God has promised that because it's foreign. You know, even the eating of animals is just weird.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get that until after the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Well, no, I think this is what we want to talk about. That's what we're here for. There's this great quote that I used in the memorial service I did, where I was talking about different worldviews.
Yeah.
And this is The World's View of Death by John Muir. This is something that he wrote. He says, "Let children walk with nature. Let them see the beautiful blendings and communions of death and life. Their joyous, inseparable unity, as taught in woods and meadows, plains and mountains and streams of our blessed star. And they will learn that death is stingless, indeed, and as beautiful as life, and that the grave has no victory, for it never fights. All is divine harmony."
Boy, that's born. That's.
what do you say to that? I mean,
man.
And you know, he had a battle with pneumonia that eventually killed him.
Yeah, you could say, yeah, you're right. If you're not the one that's doing it,
yeah,
you know.
I just kind of wonder. I don't know, but I mean, you know, when he was battling pneumonia on his last few hours, did he still?
Him?
What do you think about that?
Yeah.
You know, but people come out with this kind of sop.
Yeah.
And people think it's great. Oh, that's marvelous writing, right? And it gets taught, and people just think it's, oh, it's just wonderful, the circle of life. And I'm just like, you know, I mean, if you've been with someone or a relative, whatever, as they passed and they've struggled through, you know, like my mom, when she died, she had all kinds of different complications going on. She was on a kidney machine, and it was right after dialysis when she died, and I was right there and everything. And she had fought with all kinds of complications for like 10 years, constantly in the hospital, all kinds of different things. And, you know, if he was around, I would strangle the guy almost. I mean, you know, like, you didn't you come in with my mom to the hospital and tell me about how beautiful this is, you know? And how can you get away with stuff like that? I don't know. But people want to deny the ugliness of death, I guess.
I think, obviously, he didn't believe, he wasn't a believer, because it's just not there, you know, that's just not the way it is.
Mm-mm.
It's not what God meant.
Well, when you have no answer to it, it serves your purpose to come up with spin it such a way that it's, because if it's inevitable and there's no life after death, might as well spin it around and, you know, take the sting out of it.
Yeah,
although
being scared of it.
Yeah, I mean, so it kind of makes sense on that level.
Yeah.
Although it's absurdity, you know, like you said, if this guy was actually on his own deathbed or witnessed a loved one, you know, and especially a painful, agonizing death, which a lot of them are, he might amend that a little bit.
I think the only thing I agree in the whole thing he says there is he says that death never fights. And I would say that's true, because death always wins.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to fight. You know? I mean, how many people do... I mean, you know, if you read any history book, right, you'd be reading, you know, like the Gold Rush. And you see a photo... I'm just thinking of a particular photo in one book we have where it's down the Seattle waterfront, and there's a ship packed with people going to the Gold Rush, and the docks are packed with people... You know, when you look at the date on that photo, every single one of those people is gone.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a single person in that picture alive. You know, you don't think that way all the time. But when you look at those photos, and you look at, you know, just how effective is death right now? It's 100% effective, you know, except for these 0.00000001. You know, like Enoch and Elijah. I mean, but it's just this huge thing. It's, you know, like I like to say, is that, you know, without the Bible, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's an oncoming train.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and another way of looking at it is, that, you know, it's God's choker chain on man's imagined independence.
Yeah.
Like God has this chain. He says, you can run, go ahead and run out to the end of this chain, but there's an end on this chain, and at the end, it's just you and me. And, you know, if you want to deny me and you want to live in a way that completely is opposite to me, you got this chain. But at some point, you know, great and small, rich and poor, you reach the end of that chain, and you got to deal with, you know, like it says, it's appointed to man once to die, and then the judgment. To me, that's God's, that's his chain.
It seems pretty clear that his main purpose for shortening people's lives was they had less of a chance for depravity. I mean, if you're living 900 years, that is a long time to walk down dark roads, you know. And it seems to me after the flood, that was a conscious thing. Okay, man is only going to live so long. You know, I don't know. That's kind of how I see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the reason he did that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he has a guy too, when he was ready to die, and he rolled over in his bed and was crying to God, and God gave him 15 more years. And it was probably the worst 15 years of his life. And but God was going to bless him by shortening his time.
Yeah.
But he didn't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I mean, I was not a Christian for a long time, and I'm not really sure. I was younger, though, so I didn't think about death that much, right? So as you get older, of course, you think more about death for, I don't know why, but, you know, I just kind of, there's days where I wake up and I think, well, gee, just how differently I would feel if I wasn't a believer.
Yeah.
You know, what would I do to try to escape the reality of that? Whereas now I don't have to escape the reality of it. I can fully accept it and not labor under, you know, these alternate views which are either hugely scary and unknown, the possibility that hell's real and I'm going there, and the third one is, well, nothingness. You know, those are, you know, and that's like, that's why, you know, when you go to a hospital and there's sick people there, right? Unless you're a Christian, there's nothing to offer people that, you know, they're terminally ill. Mm-hmm. My sister works in a cancer ward. She's not a believer. And, you know, she is really good relationally with people. She's like an excellent nurse, and she's really good at getting to know people and relating to people. And she doesn't have anything to offer them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why I pray that, well, God will use that all the time.
Because what a great platform. I mean, she's still working for somebody, so
right.
She has to have responsibility in it, but still, yeah.
But also just that, you know, she'll come to a place where she realizes that, you know, 8 out of 10 of these patients aren't leaving here or whatever it is. And all I can do is make them feel comfortable for a few days or, you know, a month or whatever. And, you know, that in itself is enormously valuable, but it's still, ultimately, it doesn't really get to the bottom of where most of those people are, where we're all going to go, you know, short of the rapture. So it just, that whole business about God overcoming death, that's where, to me, you know, I mean, it's hard to pick your favorite verse in the Bible, right, because there's so many favorites, but one of my favorites in a film, Bible verse in a film, of course they got these different Jesus films, right? But there's one in particular that's, and he's one of my favorite Jesuses too. And anyway, when he's at the tomb of Lazarus, and he says, "I am the resurrection and the life," I just about fall in my chair every time I see that. Mm-hmm. It's like, I just can't, you know.
Quite a statement.
You know, and that's you know, that's what I brought up with a friend of mine who was asking me questions, who's not a believer. He was asking me questions about the Bible and stuff when I was working with him about 6 months ago, and he was going down the path of yeah, there's a lot of good religious teachers and Jesus is one of them, you know, even though he doesn't know anything about really what Jesus taught. And I told him, I says, no, you can't say that. Jesus is not just a good religious teacher, because on your terms he's a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
I says, you know, what would you think if I stood up and I said, I am the resurrection and the life? You know, are you going to call me a good teacher? I mean, it's either true or I'm a lunatic. I'm a loony bin, right?
Yeah.
So you try to tell me that you think he's a great teacher, and he's spouting off stuff that you think is completely lunatic.
What did he say to any of that?
He goes, oh, You know. But
did he probably say, well, I guess he's not that good a teacher?
Well, he's better off to have that view than to fool himself into thinking he's like, you know, a great religious teacher or whatever. Jesus taught so many things that are so like radical that he doesn't allow us to put him in a convenient little box, whether we're a believer or unbeliever, right?
Yeah, if you really know what he's taught, other than just a few cliches, you can't. He won't let you take that view if you have any knowledge of some of what he taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a problem, you know, me included, all of us. We don't know, you know. You know a few of the things, the popular, you know, cultural things.
Before you come to faith, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the teachers who I've learned a lot from. His name is Charles Clough. He talks a lot about different ways that the world takes the teachings of Jesus and makes them acceptable and kind of swallows them and puts them in he likens it to a pill, right, where you have, you know, something that tastes like cod liver oil, and then they put like the candy coating around it, right? So there's these teachings in the Bible that if you can coat them, encapsulate them, or reinterpret them in certain ways, then people don't have to be too nervous about dealing with what was really being said. And he just talks about all the techniques that the world has for taking the power out of what Jesus really said and interpreting it a different way. But it is an interesting thing that it's like a hot potato, you know. It's like, if you really take it at face value, it's a hot potato. What do you do with it, you know? But anyway, I love that where he says, "I am the resurrection and the life." But it is interesting in Luke 20. There's another spot where Jesus describes those who are resurrected, and it's that place where his challengers come up and say, well, there was a woman who was married seven times, seven different husbands, and therefore in the resurrection, verse 33 of Luke 20, in the resurrection, whose wife does she become? All seven had her as a wife. And part of what Jesus says, he says in verse 35, those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage, nor can they die anymore. For they're equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. So when he says they're equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection, I think what he's emphasizing there, that in the same way that Adam was directly the son of God, had eternal life at that point, or that Jesus is directly the son of God, the angels are directly the son of God, when we're born again, we're also directly the sons and daughters of God. So we're plugged into the life giver, you know, the Prince of Life. And so that connection makes us essentially have this eternal life. But it's great when he's just in passing talking about other things, he happens to mention, well, they can't die anymore.
Yeah.
Yippee!
Yeah.
So, and then as Jerry mentioned, you see this come to fulfillment in Revelation chapter 20. After the millennial kingdom in Revelation 20 verse 14, it mentions there that death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. In the next chapter, I think it's verse 4, it says, there shall be no more death. So it's like, you know, what was it we were talking about another time too, no more sin. Like there's certain things that are so far removed from our experience that it almost becomes, it is impossible for us in our current state to really understand what all the ramifications would be, right? I mean, if you lived in a world where there was no sin, there's just so many things that would change about relationships and locks and keys and passwords and police forces and military and, you know, whatever. And the same is true of no more death, right?
Yeah.
Our culture, I think we do everything we can to kind of hide and suppress death, you know, and we have a lot of, in the past, where sickness and the aspects of sin related to death would be in our midst, they're kind of pulled away, like for instance, insanity, or when we have relatives who are seriously ill, or, you know, deathly ill. some of that sometimes we don't get involved with because it's in a hospital or whatever. We're back in the old days, and the pioneers, they were there at your house till the end. You had to deal with however much it escalated or how complicated it got, you had to deal with it, which I'm not voting for that.
Right.
But I am saying that there was a value in that you maybe had a more direct exposure to how frequent death is and also the ravages of death. It's kind of, it would be harder to pretend or ignore it, you know, pretend it wasn't as serious when you know, kids maybe have a sickness and then they're debilitated for all the rest of their life and you're dealing with that in your family, you know, like when that kind of thing happens. And really, when you boil down, well, where does that come from? It's sin and it's death still, so...
You know, God is, he's just so merciful, you know, because even just in the creation, when like a tree falls over and dies, you know, it decomposes and actually becomes fertile soil or something to grow in. But, and when people try and equate that to, you know, that's part of that circle of life, that, oh, it's a beautiful thing, that's just a lie, you know. That guy who wrote that, equating God's mercy towards us, and when you extend that to actually people, you know, that's a lie. You know, it's just, talk to someone whose kid just died, you know, and then...
Well, that's also the opportunity of memorial service.
Because
you got a bunch of people here, at that point in time, they're very aware that death has a sting.
Yeah.
And so... You know, and it also brings you to a place where you're thinking about things that matter, you know, because a lot of the distractions that we're all immersed in distractions all the time, and when you lose a loved one or you go to a memorial service of somebody you love, that's the rare occasion where you really get to see the perspective of, okay, this life is short and uncertain, so. What is life about? Is it just about what we're doing here, or is there a bigger purpose and a bigger picture? And you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I can get pretty angry about, is just this dumbing down of death and stuff, because it does such a disservice. And you know, like I've said before, in the schools where we teach these kids that they're purposeless. You know, they're here by chance, there's no real purpose, there's no real ethics, but go out and change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Be anything you can be, and by the way, it's all pointless.
That's why they can commit.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like criminal, you know, because they're right on a launching pad of their life. It's like right when they should be really taking off and really starting to find a purpose and fulfillment in the plan of God. And then we teach them, oh, you're just chance, random.
Yeah.
You're just another monkey.
Yeah.
And you know, and then when you see people have these speeches of valedictorians or the graduation speeches, and you just want to go up there and say, what are you talking about? If you say this is true and this is true and this is true, then there's no point in any of what you're talking about.
Well, they're not allowed to talk about Jesus or anything like that. That's forbidden.
Yeah. But yeah, even arguing what they're teaching with what your school teaches, you know, about evolution, you know, all that stuff. If you join those, they're complete. It's a mismatch. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, it's part of the deal, like, you know, when you're growing up and you think of Satan as this mythical figure with horns and a tail and pitchfork, you know, and...
he sits on your
shoulder. Yeah, those kind of things. So you don't believe there is such a thing, you know, you grow up not believing. Well, that's if they keep, you know, God out of the school and teach evolution, well, then you grow up not believing there is such a thing as a God, and that's the deception that one of the things I think that, and I may have mentioned it before, that was one of the turning points in my life was when I was working on a hot hill in California as a lineman, and I was frustrated and hot and bothered, and I'm all of a sudden it just, is this all there is? You know, is this all there is to life? You get up, you go to work, you come, go home, go to sleep, you get up, you go to work. Every once in a while you get a week off for vacation, you get up, go to work, come home, go to sleep. I mean, is this all there is? You know? I think God started answering my questions.
Mm-hmm. So. And I think that question is, yeah. I mean, we're designed to ask
yeah.
that question.
I think it's a major question in people's lives. Is there a God? Is this all there is? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and if these guys who believe that our brains are just evolved chemicals, I mean, why does our brain ask that question
yeah.
in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Why should it even care?
Yeah.
Right? But it does, because we, you know, God is imprinted on our being in the core. We know there is a God, like Romans says.
Mm-hmm.
And we're designed, we're like, we need something bigger than ourselves or we self-destruct. You know,
yeah.
And that's what you're always saying too. When we always come to the limits of these things, and Kevin always says, "Well, I'm sure glad God is so much bigger than us, and we can't figure this stuff out because
yeah.
what if we could?"
Yeah, what if we could? What if we could answer all these questions and make nice, neat little bows of all these really tough things? That's not a good thing.
No,
that would not be a good thing.
No,
I think He designed this. So that you can't ever do that.
Yeah.
No matter how much you dig in there, there's always more.
There's certain themes
yeah.
that we'll just never be able to get closer
yeah.
as we move through.
Mm-hmm.
But you know,
if you look at that family dynamic between like a young child and the parents, you know, ultimately we're designed really to be children of
yeah.
God,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so there's a sense in which when if we don't believe God is there, we don't have that parent in our
yeah.
in our lives, and it's just like we like to think that okay, well maybe we don't need that, but really it's a need we have, and it's like running a car on the wrong gas or something, or putting water in the gas tank or something. It's like and that's why it's so frustrating when you do get some psychologist expert on TV and they ask them about why this or why that or the other, and if they don't happen to have a biblical worldview, you know, they never come up with the answer. One of the answers is, you know, this car is designed to run on gasoline and you're putting, you know, wax in it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's going to malfunction, you know, it's a malfunction that's part of the whole scheme, and that the more society moves away from a belief in God, the more malfunction there's going to be, whether it, you know, and it's going to manifest itself in all different ways.
We see
lack
that
of peace.
Now, I think, I mean, it's. I asked Terry if, you know, what she thinks, because see, it just seems like evil is just growing. I mean, it's just more and more and more and more
mm-hmm.
women, mothers drowning their kids, and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, just stuff like this. It's just total evil, and you think, wow, this is it's getting bad. You know,
mm-hmm.
God's got to come soon. And
mm-hmm.
It's
you know, maybe there'd be a weird case like that once a year somewhere you'd
yeah,
hear,
I never
but like
heard
every
that.
Month.
Yeah,
you
even
know,
more so.
Yeah, if you're just looking at the news headlines. Either the news is doing a lot better job of digging up weird stuff, or there's
yeah.
a lot more weird stuff going on. And I think it's a little both.
Yeah.
Mostly there's a lot more of it going on.
I think there is.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like, you know, I honestly believe that there's demonic activity out there, and demons get stimulated with an evil. When something happens, you know,
mm-hmm.
like the school shooting or whatever, and the demons out there are getting excited, you know, and
mm-hmm.
they want to go do the same thing or go shoot up a theater or something, you know. And it's I believe in that there's demons in operation right now. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. I mean, you hear like the woman who drowned her kids in the car. She was hearing voices telling her to do that, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. you start hearing voices telling you to do something, there's demons and activity right mm-hmm. there, you know. It's just mm-hmm. seems like to me anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there were demons back in Jesus' time, there mm-hmm. are demons now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing to think that still isn't going on. Mm-mm. We're just not as aware of it anymore.
Well, here we aren't because we're kind of the way we grow up and mm-hmm. things we're taught.
Right.
It just doesn't enter into it,
yeah.
you know.
Right.
Even going to church, they don't really talk about demonic activities
no.
that much, you know. So.
Yeah. I think there's a number of reasons for that. You know, part of it is part of it is it's an unpleasant subject,
yeah.
you know, and another part of it is that the world ridicules the idea.
Yeah,
you know?
They laugh at you.
Yeah, but it's just like you see these incredibly heinous things that happen.
Yeah,
you know, and human flesh is capable of some amazingly awful things, but you have to say there are things that happen that you look at times and you go, there's got to be more to it than just that, because they're just so dark that you just can't. This is hard to believe. I mean, it's just unmasked, incredible, dark evil, you know.
Yeah.
And often the other thing you see too is, I mean, a lot of times you hear this too. Well, that guy was the most normal guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what pushed the gas pedal there, right? What was it that all of a sudden it went way beyond anything anyone thought that person could do? Is it just that they decided today I'm going to be a little different, or were there demonic forces involved, you know? I think you have to, as a Christian, you have to ask that question.
Well, when we're told that our battle is not physical but
mm-hmm.
spiritual, then,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it right there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all Satan, because Satan's not a omnipresent
right.
being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got all of his little minions out there, and that's their job.
Yeah. So this whole
that's a cheery thing to
well,
it's the truth.
But
it's,
you know,
yeah.
we're Christians, and we're not susceptible to demonic activity. Influence maybe, but not possession anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where we're supposed to be wise as serpents. We're
yeah.
supposed, but innocent. We're supposed to be aware of these things, but meditate on the what's good and what's pure and what's
yeah.
lovely. You know,
yeah.
that's so. Yeah, we can have a discussion like this, and like going home. It's good. I mean,
uh-huh.
We have to do that. You just don't want to eat that every day.
Yeah, and I think there is, I mean, it's kind of a side rabbit, we're on it a little bit, but there is this issue, too, about as Christians, you know, as the culture moves more to embrace darkness in an open way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, darkness has always been there, but it's come out more. Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, Debbie talks to me about this. I mean, she's involved in the American Christian Fiction Writers Conference and various Christian organizations writing fiction, and some of the people writing Christian fiction are, you know, they're writing horror, essentially Christian horror or Christian
mm-hmm.
vampires or
yeah.
right, and at some point you got to get back to the Philippians deal about, you know, whatever is true and lovely. There's an issue where, and the same thing comes up with like video games or even
yeah.
movies, right, where sometimes as Christians, people feel like, well, you know, we're free to do whatever we want to do, and this isn't explicitly in here, but, you know, some of that stuff is so dark, and it's the realm of the demonic. That's where the demonic, I think, gains an opening into people's lives in a big way. And Christians want to flirt around with some of that stuff. And I think that's a big issue in,
yeah.
in our time, that I think there, you know, I think that as the culture drifts, the, you know, Christianity can drift with the culture, and it's the only thing that keeps us from drifting is this anchor here. And if we're, you know, if we're just in the scriptures, you know, 15 minutes every 2 weeks, and the rest of the time we got that flood of what's coming in from the culture, and we're not discerning about it, we're going to be losing discernment, and we're going to be end up like some of these writers, thinking we're doing evangelistic work, writing about satanic things in our books.
Witches and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, and it's you know, and sometimes it gets to the point where it's fairly obvious it's kind of crazy, because like someone will have like the Harry Potter. The Harry Potter study Bible or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And I mean, it's one of those deals where, you know, how far do you go with evangelism? You know, do you
not
make
that far.
Yeah, do you,
that's a pretty easy one.
Yeah, do you make a Jesus and the Apostles Ouija board?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
Where do you go to reach people? You know, and there are some tough questions there, but some of this stuff, and what bugs me about this especially is among young guys that are Christians, the two big issues are pornography and video games. And the video games are incredibly dark. And the video games and pornography are coming together.
Yeah, sure.
So that you have incredibly dark, violent, and harsh stuff that's explicitly sexual. And it's hard to imagine a darker area. And meanwhile, places are developing, you know, and I'm not a big fearmonger about technology, but, you know, some people I know that I work with were working at a company that was bought by Oculus, which was bought by Facebook, and, you know, they're working on these virtual reality goggles, right, where when you have these things on, it's a 3D world that's completely virtual with super high speed and resolution graphics.
So you're completely immersed.
You're completely immersed.
Yeah.
All your senses are immersed. Yeah. You can look behind you. I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, it's, you're there physically, other than the touch and everything. And but the thing about that whole area is, it's neutral technology, but the push behind it is largely gaming, and that gaming is not neutral.
Mm-hmm.
It's very heavily violent, and you know, and I. Personally, I've walked into places with Christian young guys in their houses, and I see games that, like, whoa, Dark Souls, or, you know, things like that, that I go, well, wait a minute. You think you can worship God and not defile your temple with that? I mean, how does that really work with Scripture? It doesn't.
I think you can leave an opening for evil to come in, you know. I mean, I talked about that Ouija board thing before, and I believe that's a tool used by Satan to actually gain entry into a, you know, for demonic activities or whatever, you know, because it's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Terry was telling me when she got so scared when they did that when she was a kid,
mm-hmm.
that she couldn't go around that anymore, you know, because it's a very, very scary thing. So it's, I think we leave ourselves open. As Christians, we can do that. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's what you're basically talking about there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many ways of doing it that it's...
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because all those... I don't watch them, but I see ads for them, and all those vampires and werewolf things, they all have a sensual undertone to them, you know, and I can just see that getting more graphic, you know, and more extreme. I mean, I see ads for video games sometimes, and what they, you know, it's definitely moving that direction, where it'll be, there won't be a lot of difference between the two, you know, pornography and all that,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I don't know what it is about violence. I don't know. But they attract each other, right? Because it's somehow sensuality is
stimulating.
They're attracted. They're going to merge,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't quite understand all that. But.
No. But it's like it's the incredible, it's like the worst possible potion.
Yeah.
You know? Because you know, it takes, you know, sexual intimacy, which is a beautiful thing that God's designed, and it absolutely defaces it. And so there's
but the merging with the violence is a mystery to me, because I didn't grow up with video games. So violence has never been an attraction, you know, really, you know, and so I don't know how the two, why the two merge. I get pornography, you know, I understand that,
right.
You know, but how the, why that merges with violence,
I don't. Well, I think
it's a dark road, one of the few dark roads I've ever been down.
Well, you know, if you read Leviticus 18, we don't really have time to read Leviticus 18, but if you read Leviticus 18, I mean, if you read it seriously, it's hard to make it through the chapter.
Yeah.
Because it's talking about women mating with animals, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, bestiality. And it gets to the end and says, I don't want you to do these things because this is what the nations around you are doing. And,
that's heavy.
it's not like a study in what's possible. It's a declaration. This is what's going on in the land of Canaan. So when you see that, even back then in the biblical record, right, or Sodom and Gomorrah, whatever, you see those situations, and you realize that, like we talked about, sin is active, and it's pushing the boundaries all the time. That's why the homosexual agenda has never been just about this or that. It's always, now we have this, we want that, and once we have this, we want that. And then pedophilia will follow on its tails, and polygamy is right in there with it as well. They're all, and it's not like you're just fighting one situation that only wants to take one more beachhead. And the culture just doesn't seem to realize that. And so I think that's part of what's there is behind it. There, you know, the human flesh reacts, but there is a demonic agenda to destroy everything that's good, everything that's God, and how better to do that than to take something that's supposed to be incredibly tender and motivated by trust and love, and then involve physical violence. Right, the exact opposite extreme, and put them together like a sweet and sour.
Yeah,
I like sweet and sour soup, but
no, that's a good point. Actually.
You know, it's like taking this thing that's meant to be a certain way, and then wedding it with the polar opposite. You know, what people hack each other up in a war, and now put that together with sexual intimacy or whatever, and it's hard to call it intimacy at that point, but it's, you know, and I first kind of, the first thing that really hit me about this is when I was I'd only been a Christian about 3 years, I went on a business trip to Japan, and I was working on a project for Sony, you know, the big Sony company, and we went on a tour of a bunch of different places. They took us to a virtual reality lab, and they took us to a museum, and it was all real interesting. And anyway, we were in this big building of Sony, and we walked through a room. We just went through the room to the other side. It was a fairly big room, and we walked in that room, and the whole wall had like 90 monitors going, and they were all XXX stuff.
It's hard to believe Sony would be involved in that. You think of more more backdoor companies.
It's money.
Yeah, I guess so.
Not only that, they're not a Christian society over there either. There's some that are Christian, but most of them aren't Christian. Shintoism and all kinds of stuff over there.
That had to get your attention.
Yeah, so if you're someone who doesn't have a TV and then. And as a Christian, obviously you're not hanging out with pornography. Then you see not like one, not like two, not like 10, not like 20, but like 100.
Yeah.
And you just glance at the wall. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, you think you're in the pit right there, right?
Yeah.
That's probably how it.
I mean, it's just
overtakes.
It's
you,
one
you
of
know?
Those things. It's. I mean, it's not like seeing someone murdered, but I mean, it's the same kind of thing that. It makes an imprint on your brain, and you wish you never saw it, right?
Yes.
And that's a lot about what this stuff does is it takes away innocence, takes away what's pure and lovely, and it puts in images that are you can't get rid of them, and they're dark, and you know. So there's that whole issue too, where your eyes are a gateway into your brain, just like your ears are, and and other things, and so you have to guard those things if you want to avoid those situations. But still, you know, it's kind of related to this whole business where we've been talking about the sting of death is sin, and that, you know, why is it horror and violence? Well, that's death, and that's tied to sin. And it's almost like if there were no sin, there'd be no death. And that's where God's taking things.
Yeah.
So when you look at violence and sin, there's that connection with death. And so that's why, in a sense, you could say we're developing a culture of death. And you kind of see, I mean, it, in some ways it's kind of goofy, but I mean, everyone's wearing bones on their clothes all the time,
that
kind of stuff, right? Or black or whatever, and things come and go. Next it'll be pink and something else, I know. But still there's this, like in the Bible it says all the time, why do you seek the living among the dead? Why do you seek the God of the living among the dead? And there's this whole fascination with necromancy and with the occult and with the demonic. And God is saying, look, I'm the source of life. I'm the prince of life. I'm here to give you life, and you won't come to me. You keep going to this death stuff. And you can see the culture doing that same thing.
And I know a lot of people that say that Halloween is their favorite holiday.
Yeah.
And they're not friends of mine, but I've heard people, young women, you know, in their early 20s say that, more than one, Halloween is my favorite. It's that same thing. It's fueling, I don't know, you know, don't think of Halloween as that serious, but I think, you know, it's got that darker side to it, you know. And
So kind of morbid, but,
yeah.
You know, the beautiful part is death's going to be swallowed up in victory.
Yeah.
And part of that process is that the penalty of sin is going to be removed, because sin itself will be dealt with.
And what's he talking about there? He's talking about the rapture. That's when death will be swallowed up in victory for us at the rapture, and literally at the end of the tribulation, so, or at the millennium. So it's kind of the Bible kind of personifies death, makes it, it's like a person, you know, and it's kind of. So you see that in some of the movies there too, but it's the way it's characterized.
And it's like even though the curse was put in place by God in reaction to man's sin, there's still this issue where it's like you see passages where God is almost offended by the fact that his creation is marred by this. You know, he says, they will not destroy in all my holy mountain, right? Kind of this idea he's saying. You know, I've had enough of this marred, my creation being marred. I'm going to get rid of that destruction, and it's going to be beautiful, and there'll be life, and it's pretty neat.